need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Nature Backed, a talk show where we are talking with investors and entrepreneurs about the green future. My name is Tarmo Virki, and today my guest is Shrubber Ali from the Garden of Wildlife. Welcome to Nature Backed, Shrubber.
Thank you, Tarmo. It's great to be here.
What is Garden for Wildlife?
So Garden for Wildlife is an e-commerce business, although we're getting into physical retail as well here in the U.S. as a starting point. That is making it easy for people to learn about, get educated on, and then purchase and have delivered right to their doorstep native plants for their yard. So we're a plant business is the simplest way of putting it. But so much more.
E-commerce plant business.
Yes.
What's the kind of the, I don't know, science behind it or the native plants? It's probably something which is changing in time.
So actually, no. So it's very interesting because I only discovered this myself about 4.5 years ago. Prior to that, I was, you know, had a very different career, as I would think you've seen from my LinkedIn, you know, management consulting with Accenture, Salesforce is doing innovation in software and multiple startups. But I've always been a gardener just in my own yard. Wherever I've lived, I've always put, you know, flowers and plants in because I thought it was helping the environment by putting in stuff that feeds the pollinators and the birds, et cetera. Well, about 4.5 years ago, I read a book that had just come out by a professor from the University of Delaware here. The book's called Nature's Best Hope. And that's where I discovered the fundamental problem that most people are not aware of, which is that we have slowly transformed our environment around us, particularly not just in the U.S., across the globe, as I think everybody's aware, but in the U.S. here specifically, we have systematically ripped out much of the native plants that are around, the flowers, the shrubs, the trees, et cetera, and replaced them with invasive species. And the most egregious example, of course, is lawns. Everybody has a lawn. Almost nobody uses their lawn, but they water, they mow, they fertilize, they do this over and over and over again. And what we've done in the process is destroy the habitat that the pollinators, particularly the native bee species, of which there are about 400 in the U.S., and the butterflies have been declining significantly. Some are endangered. The monarch everybody knows about is the most extreme example where, you know, we have, I think, a 90% reduction in their population. But what people don't realize is the connection that I discovered in the book as well is between the disappearance of the pollinators and the disappearance of the birds. And many of the different songbird species that have been around since I was a child growing up, 3 billion nesting pairs of songbirds have disappeared in the U.S., not because people let their cats go outside, which is the usual, you know, conventional wisdom. It's actually because we destroyed their food source, which was the caterpillars from the pollinators. And all this just because we ripped out native plants. And instead, if you go to the local garden center at most big box stores in the cities around here and all across the country, what they sell are plants from other parts of the world. And they're pretty, they look nice, people like to put them in their gardens, but they're essentially like plastic food. And the result being that the insects can't feed on them very well, but especially the caterpillars. And because they can't, then you don't get the adult insects. And then because of that, the birds can't feed their offspring. And you see the cycle break. And it's broken through one very simple problem, which is people are planting the wrong plants.
So how far are you in the road of fixing this? Because it's massive.
It is massive. And we are at very early stages. So the backstory here is, again, about 4.5 years ago, I read this book and I was a partner. I was one of the global leads for innovation at Accenture, which is a big management consulting firm I think a lot of people know of. And I had just moved to this area where I live now, outside of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. And the house that I have has about 2 acres of lawn. And so I was going to put in a garden and get rid of much of the grass. And that's when I discovered that I had the wrong plants. So I went to go look for native plants and they were very difficult to find because they don't sell them at the big stores. And so I reached out to the National Wildlife Federation, which is one of the leading not-for-profits in the U.S. in the environmental space. And they've had a program for 50 years called Garden for Wildlife, which was an education program about the science and the connection of, you know, putting native plants in and the impact on environment. And they've even had a program for certifying your yard. And over the last 50 years since they launched the program, almost 300,000 properties have been certified as wildlife habitats, most of them homes, but about 10,000 schoolyards as well, and some businesses. So went to them and said, we need to solve a problem that I have, but I think millions of gardeners, there are over 180 million gardeners in the US. Most of them don't even know what a native plant is. And they go to the local store thinking they're buying the right thing, like I was doing for decades. So we had to solve the problem by going through awareness, education, and then availability. And that meant creating supply. It wasn't enough just to educate people if they can't buy the plants once they know I need native plants, and then they look around and they can't find them, because people will still go to what's convenient. So we did a series of workshops with them. All this I did pro bono, the result of which was the design for an e-commerce business, which they agreed to. So then we ended up building that on Shopify and Salesforce for the National Wildlife Federation, and they launched it in late 2021. And I was the very first customer. So those plants are in my yard and they're doing great. About a year later, I went back to them and said, you should spin this out as a for-profit company, because, which again is breaking the traditional model of the not-for-profit, but because if you know, in e-commerce, you need to be able to recruit the right people, you need to be able to pay the right salaries, you need to be able to then tap into investors. You can't do that inside a not-for-profit. And they're a not-for-profit, so they don't really know how to run a business of this kind. And so they agreed and said, we will spin this out, but you need to come in and be the CEO, because you built companies before and you know how this, and you designed the company. And so I said, I would love to do this. I mean, it's a huge change for my career, but it's like given me a sense of purpose that no work I've ever done before in my life has been as meaningful as this. So I said, absolutely, you know, where it. So I quit my perfectly good job and came over and started at Garden for Wildlife about a year and a half ago. And it took about 10 months to actually spin out, because it's very complicated to take a for-profit out of a not-for-profit. Usually it's the other way around, creating a little foundation or a not-for-profit subsidiary or whatever. So we did it. And the National Wildlife Federation is our biggest shareholder, but we've also brought in outside investors. We have employee options for the employees. I'm an investor in the company as well as employee, obviously. And we actually launched last fall, and we're closing at the end of this month, a crowdfunding round. So we said, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are gardeners. They can now invest in the future by investing in the company as well. So we did that, which allowed us to access, you know, a much broader range of people too. But the goal is to grow this thing, because the marketplace, and this is what was appealing as well to the National Wildlife Federation, is the market for gardening in the US alone is $50 billion. We did the research when I was at Accenture before we started this. It's hyper fragmented. Nobody owns the market. It's not like, you know, a market like most places where you think of an obvious duopoly or three or four big leaders in the end. There's no market leader here. And there's definitely no market leader when it comes to natives. It's a highly fragmented, very localized business. So what we want to do is roll up part of that by working with and creating a network of small growers who supply us. And then we are the face and the brand to many customers across the country. And the way we did this is by building this platform, and now working with, you know, we've got now a retail partner who actually is selling our plants in their stores as well. So we're expanding. We're in 41 states after 2 years, which is great. And we expect to be across most of the US by late next year.
What about the rest of the world? Do you know the initiatives in the rest of the world? Are you know, do we have the kind of country specific wildlife seed plant things in other countries? Or
yes, and in fact, I mean, the first next country we're expanding into is Canada, for obvious reasons, because it's just over the border, and wildlife doesn't look at, you know, political boundaries. So
yeah,
that makes sense. But I was at the climate conference in Dubai last December and talked with a number of people from Europe in particular, but also from the Middle East, that are interested in putting in native plants and expanding the range of that. Because the same problem exists everywhere. It's just different plants are native to different places. And creating supply of that and educating people about the importance of it, what I think a lot of people don't realize is there are a wide range of beautiful native plants to your area. It's not what you see at the store. You see what, you know, the vendors put in front of you, and then that's what you pick from and buy. But when people see the native plants that are available, they go, wow, those are amazing. they buy those instead. It's like if you go to the grocery store and you see organic and you see, you know, highly processed, if you have a choice, 15 years ago, organic was a very, very niche. Now, look, you go and it's everywhere in all major grocery stores. And the same thing with non-dairy alternatives. When that started with soy milk 20, 30, 40 years ago, it was this little niche thing you found in health stores. Now I walk into my local grocery store, mainstream grocery store, two out of the five cabinets are in the dairy section are not dairy. There's oat, there's almond, there's soy, there's, you know, cashew, there's all kinds of choices.
Same in this part of the world.
Yeah, I
In
assume,
there's
yes.
yeah, there's a number of coffee shops you have to ask for that cow milk, please, for my coffee.
Yes. Yeah, and it's not everybody will do this. Some people will want to keep their big lawns, and that's fine. But what we're finding is a lot of people are actually going, oh, I can take a portion of my yard. I'll just take a corner of it and start. And what they start to see, the wildlife comes back. That what I'm talking about again is like these amazing butterflies, where it's I dug a pond in my yard and turtles just magically showed up. Now I have three turtles living in my pond. And of course, all the birds that have shown up, there's a great app I have on my phone. I think it's available globally now. It's from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is one of our partners. And it's called Merlin. It's a free app. You can download it. And it's the way I describe it is it's Shazam for birds. So it literally, you just put it out, you hit record, and it listens to the birds and immediately tells you which bird it is, gives you information on them, pictures, all the rest, and it's all free. So when you start doing things like this in your yard, you'll notice the change in the biodiversity around your house almost immediately.
I will definitely download the app after this recording, and we'll add the link to the app to the show notes so the listeners can
Please
also
do.
find it easily, because it's quite amazing. I also have a place in the countryside where just, you know, you don't need to open the windows in the springtime, but you can just hear inside the house all the birds singing around your house.
Which I love. I mean, I wake up early in the morning and I can hear the birds waking up as the sun comes up and I'm having my coffee. It's actually something that I think in the pandemic, people are starting to, we've become as a society more aware of mental health and the importance of mental health, but also physical health. And the pandemic, I think, kind of forced us to address this at a level we've never really dealt with before. And one of the things that I've discovered just in the last 2 years of doing this is there is a world of information, of science-backed information on the importance of exposure to nature for your mental and physical health, right? There's a fantastic book written by a woman, Florence Williamson, I think is her name, or Williams. It's called The Nature Fix. It came out in 2017. It goes through a lot of the science of like the forest bathers in Japan, who they've measured them. They actually did all the medical tests on them before and after. And they've shown that exposure to nature isn't temporary. It's not like, you know, you get this nice feeling of peace and all the rest for an hour. It actually lasts for a month. It's a long time improvement in your systolic rate, in your cortisol levels, in all kinds of things, which just kind of makes sense when you think about it for a moment. And so what we're trying to do is get people to actually create a little bit of that oasis where they are. Instead of a sterile environment around your house, what if you brought back good parts of nature and supported the biodiversity at the same time? Because, and then I'll get off my soapbox here, but there's a professor from Harvard University. He's passed away now, but he was probably one of the preeminent leaders in the field, Edward Wilson, E.O. Wilson. And he's written a wide range of books on biodiversity and insects and all the rest. He had a saying, and I'm paraphrasing because he was much more eloquent, but he said, you know, if the human race disappeared in 10,000 years, you would not have even known we were here. Right, all evidence would just be erased by nature. It would figure it out and pretty much get rid of us. But if insects disappear in 100 years, we're gone because we rely so much on insects for so many different things. And people are the biggest one being food production and the pollinators that are required. And the loss of pollinators should scare the bejesus out of people, and they don't even understand it's happened. And so this is a way to start to actually address a problem that. I mean, there's climate change, there's plastic in the Pacific, there's all kinds of massive problems out there. This is one that you can actually do something about and see the result outside your own home. And that's why I'm so excited about the business because, you know, we're only 2 years old and we've already planted over 1 million square feet of habitat in the US.
It's a good beginning, as they say. We will go for a short break now. We'll be back in a minute after these messages from our sponsors. Welcome back. The link between the kind of wildlife in the gardens and the bees, because I think over the last few years, people have increasingly around the world understood the problem of having no bees out there. How big is the link?
Well, so I consider the bees just as part of the wildlife. What's interesting in the US is that people don't realize there's a very good article that just came out last week about this, but people don't realize when they think about the bees disappearing, the bees that people have been talking about in the news here in the US are actually from Europe. They're European honeybees, right? That's the joke. It's that they're not the ones you should worry about. It's the other 400 species of bees in the US that are declining. One in four is in danger of extinction. I mean, this is how bad it's getting. The European honeybees, ironically, are actually doing fine. While individual colonies are collapsing and collapsing at an alarming rate, people have been starting new ones at a higher rate than they are disappearing. So the actual number of these European honeybees has actually increased in the US. The fact that they're collapsing is a different and concerning issue because essentially we're doing to bees what we did to cattle and pigs and all kinds of and chickens and the rest, which is creating almost like industrialized agriculture of bees, which is not good for them, which is why they're dying off. But they just grow them faster than they died, so they think it's not a problem. The bigger issue is what's happening to the larger insect environment out there of all the other pollinators, bees and butterflies, because they all produce the food for us. And if people keep putting in honeybee hives thinking they're helping again, just like planting the wrong invasive species thinking they're helping, what they should do is plant more native plants then as well, because they compete with the local pollinators for that same food. And so if you are going to have a beehive, and I know people who have beehives and have honey, I'm like, that's fine, do it, but plant extra native plants so you have more food for all of them. That's the solution.
The 41 states covered so far. What's the challenge? Is it the kind of regulations from one state to another in the US, or why can't you cover with a? I mean, I would guess that putting seeds in the envelope, you could send them around the world without any challenges.
Yeah, so well, and that's actually a bad problem in itself. So we don't sell seeds. We sell live plants that have actually been grown and are shipped, and they arrive in your pot. Literally, you dig a hole, stick the plant in the ground, and that's it. You don't have to fertilize. You don't have to do any pesticides or anything else because they're native. They actually are meant to be there, and they thrive. And then they come back every single year. I'll come back to the seed problem in a second, but the reason we're in 41 states, and last year it was 36 states, we just added a few more, is we have to find local growers who grow native plants, and then we add them to our network, and then they can provide for those states. We ship to multiple states from our growers, but that's not the long-term model. My model, and how we originally designed this, is that eventually we will have growers in every single state supporting that state. And the simple reason is it's shorter supply chain footprint, right? Which means, for me, one of the things that I saw when I was at the climate conference is people compartmentalizing problems and not realizing they're all interconnected. So there are people who are just talking about carbon, or people who are talking about water, and people who are talking about habitat, and people who are talking about biodiversity. I'm like, they're all one problem, right? And so this to me is, in the near term, we still ship plants from further away sometimes to get them to the customer because we don't have a local grower. In the long run, shipping a plant from Wisconsin to Connecticut doesn't have a great carbon footprint, right? So even though it's sequestering a lot of carbon in the root structure, because the amazing thing about native plants is that the root structures of some of these plants go down 15 feet, right? So I show people, like, here's lawn, and it's the roots literally go down, like, you can see I'm making those about 4 inches, right? And then, or I guess that'd be what, like 10 centimeters. And then it's just hard packed dirt. That has actually a lot of different problems. I'll go back to water quality in a moment, but you put a native plant in and their roots go down, 5, 10, 15 feet. I've got this great poster on the wall of my office that shows root systems of different native plants versus lawn. And you immediately understand the value it brings from things like when it rains, water absorption. It also cleans the water. In fact, the town I live in here, the county I live in Maryland, called Montgomery County, has a program, we just got approved for it, called Rainscapes. And the county pays you up to $7,500 to plant native rain gardens in your yard where your lawn is to help divert and clean the water that's going to run to the Chesapeake Bay, because there's all these stormwater runoff pollution problems. And by slowing it down and absorbing it in the ground and filtering it using the Earth's own processes, you avoid the downstream cleanup costs on the bay, and it heals the bay as well, right? So they realized, hey, let's just pay homeowners to put plants back in their yard that we had them rip out, you know, over the last 50 years when they built these houses. And so there's all these great ways to solve problems very simply. The thing I'll say about seeds, just so I want to come back to that, is seeds are a great example of the law of unintended consequences, and like the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? So I see people distributing native seeds all the time in packets, like, here, have some of this. The problem is they don't make sure they're only distributed to the places that they're native to. And so people end up planting, you know, they carry these seeds with them or they give them to somebody else. And then all of a sudden people are planting the wrong seeds in the wrong place. And you're creating the same problem again, which is that we're messing with the environment. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is reverse that damage.
Makes a lot of sense. Also, the challenge of, I mean, I can see the challenge of, you know, local production of the plants. It's surely something to work on quite a lot, probably.
Yeah, there's actually, it turns out, there's a whole network, it's almost below the radar, of native plant growers. The native plant industry, this is part of the chicken and egg problem. So the native plant industry is actually, in the U.S., of that $50 billion gardening industry, it's about $13 billion of it. But the vast majority of that is going to restoration work. So it's where, like, not-for-profits like the National Wildlife Federation or others or government agencies are buying huge amounts of these native plants from these small growers to do a project to restore a waterway or a median strip on a freeway or whatever. So there's actually not very much left for people like you and me, individual consumers. So what we're trying to do is create more capacity. And I'll give you an example. There's a small family farm down in Southern Virginia that we have added to our network just this last year. They wanted to grow native plants for us. They have the room, but they didn't have the greenhouse. So we bought them a greenhouse. We made the investment in the greenhouse for them that they will pay off over 2 years, and then they will own the asset. Until then, it's ours, but we transferred over to them. But they're providing us with a guaranteed supply of plants, not just for 2 years, but then for many years after that. So we're creating capacity, helping small businesses grow, and helping the environment. But that also then gives us another local grower, so we don't have to ship the plants as far to bring them in. So it becomes this, to me, the solution's right there in front of us. It's just we need to have, you know, people kind of like I brought in, and the team I've recruited, I have amazing people on my team, bring in the business skills and apply it to the environmental problem and the marketplace problem. And when we did that, we created this business.
That sounds quite amazing. We will go for a short break now. We'll be back in a minute after these messages from our sponsors. Welcome back. Tell a few words about the crowdfunding campaign, because I think logically, the business like this, where you have a lot of touch point to the consumers who should be, you know, kind of buying into the whole idea, it sounds like a natural case for the crowdfunding.
Yeah, so it's an interesting experiment. We did it this year. We will likely do it again. There are some, it's an SEC registered investment. So you have to go through a whole bunch of regulatory hoops and processes and filings. So when we end it this time, we've got some paperwork to do, a bunch of other stuff, and then we'll likely do it again. You can do it once a year. But the idea was, like you just said, you know, everyday people who are customers could also be investors. And if you're already environmentally minded, this is a chance to do something for the environment and for your portfolio. What we found is that our primary investors who are coming in, you know, again, at small amounts, like $250,000, $500,000 type investments, are exactly that. What we just did to increase that as we get to the end of the campaign is to say, and it's retroactive to everybody who's invested so far, was if you're a customer, if you're buying native plants as well, and you then invest, we will give you back your investment in the form of gift cards. But the thing with the gift cards is, so if you invest $250, we'll give you $250 in gift cards, and they're $25 gift cards. But here's the trick. You can't combine them. So you can only use one per order. And the idea is for you to give them to 10 other people. Because what you're going to do then is create 10 new people who are also going to put a small, just start their garden. And this is a campaign we just kicked off a week ago with a not-for-profit called Homegrown National Park, which is an amazing not-for-profit here in the U.S. Because this month is Native Plant Awareness Month in the U.S. And we kicked off a campaign with them that just said, just one plant. if you believe in the environment and you want to help with biodiversity and you want to help with these things, you don't have to change your whole yard. Just get one native plant, stick it somewhere in your yard. It's a starting point. It's like it's the first step in a marathon. Just get started. And so we partnered with them to help do that out. And this is kind of along the same lines. It's just find somebody who's got a yard and say, just go and here's your gift card. Just go and get like a 3-pack of plants and get started. And if everybody did this, we would not have things like the disappearing monarch and all the other, you know, problems that we have out there. And the songbirds would, you know, be coming back like they are in my yard. So that's the crowdfunding was just a way to essentially create what we call investomers, which is investor customers, because that's our best supporter.
Absolutely. And it makes so much sense. And kind of, you know, having organized a few crowdfunding campaigns myself, it's like a no-brainer. Makes all the sense in the world.
Oh, I realize that we should definitely talk more about that separately. But if it ends at the end of April, but if anybody hears this before then and you're interested, it's just invest.gardenforwildlife.com.
Absolutely. Good stuff. Any big milestones ahead for this year for the garden?
Yeah. So for my own personal garden?
For the company, I meant also.
Well, so I'm about to put all my vegetables in the garden. I grow a lot of our own food in the yard as well, which is always fun. It's my other therapy besides the plants and the birds is the vegetables, watching them grow. No, the big milestones for the company is, you know, we've got probably 3 or 4 things that we're trying to accomplish this year. We just launched a couple of months ago a new platform for not-for-profits. So essentially, and to me, this is, again, one of those coming in from the outside and looking at a problem a different way and saying, well, why wouldn't you do this? And then acting on it. And the great thing about a startup is that we went from idea to execution in 3 months, and now it's live, is we created a platform for not-for-profits where essentially, if you think about all nonprofits, one of the challenges they have is that they're all fighting for the same money, right? The donations. And so I get in the mail every week, without fail, at least 20 solicitations from perfectly worthy not-for-profits around the country who've bought mailing lists, and they spend money on these mailers to come to me trying to get me to donate to them. And I'm like, but I already have my donations to organizations. So if you think about your money in your wallet, as an individual, anybody listening here, I think probably does this kind of in their head, this mental math, but you've got a portion of your paycheck goes to your mortgage or your rent, and a portion goes to your car payment if you have one of those, and a portion goes to your food, and a portion goes to eating out and entertainment and travel and clothes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And somewhere over on the far end of that spectrum is donations. Now, you could take your mortgage and donate it, but then you wouldn't have a place to live, right? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So the question was, how do you get more money for not-for-profits? And I said, well, gardening is a $50 billion industry. What if we could get people to take some of their gardening money and put it into a not-for-profit? And the way we did it very simply is to create an affiliate program, which we're not the first ones to do this, but we created one specifically for not-for-profits. It's super easy. They come online, they sign up, they get a unique marketing code that links to Garden for Wildlife. They send it to their supporters. We don't want their mailing list. They send it to their supporters. And anybody who buys plants, they get 15% of the revenue. Just straight off the top, we just send them the money, right? And since we launched it 2 months ago, we've already had over 60 affiliates sign up, including big international ones. And like one of our most successful ones in the first 36 hours of when they launched, because partly they then have to email their supporters and let them know, you know, this is good for the environment, it's good for the not-for-profit, et cetera. You know, they sold over $10,000 in plants in 36 hours, right? Because it's spring, people are gardening, right? You just send the link out. That's all you have to do. It doesn't take any work. And anybody who buys is money for your not-for-profit. So we're really excited about launching that. The second one that we're doing is we're rolling out with a chain. It's a company called Wild Birds Unlimited. They have 350 franchises across the US and Canada. And we're now rolling out into stores with them because they're supporters. Obviously, they're customers who go to a Wild Bird store. They go there for the reason that they love birds. They buy bird houses and bird seed and all the rest. Now they'll be able to buy native plants as well, which will help support those birds also throughout the winter by creating more, you know, food and et cetera for them. Mm-hmm. So that's another big one. And honestly, just, you know, if we can do it, getting the growers on the West Coast signed up by the end of this year so we can be in those states for next year, right? Because I want to be across all 48 states as quickly as possible. And California and Washington, Oregon, et cetera, are huge markets for us. So the sooner we get there, the better.
Good stuff. And after that, Canada and the rest of the world.
Yes, the whole world needs native plants in the right place, is what it comes down to.
Absolutely. And good to have people like you helping them. Thank you so much, Robert, for your time today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dara.
Hey there, I'm DC. I host the Rock Podcast, Back to the Arena, The Interviews. It's about a 30-minute podcast where I talk one-on-one with a band who has released new music. You can find us on all the best podcast sites like Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and more. If you're a rock fan like me, subscribe today to Back to the Arena, The Interviews.
Electric Acid.
Introducing the Deep Leadership Podcast. Leadership is a people business. That's the philosophy of your podcast host, John Rennie. As a former submarine officer who spent 22 years leading businesses in corporate America before starting his own manufacturing business, he knows that leadership matters.
Leadership matters.
Deep Leadership is real-world, actionable leadership advice from John and his expert guests. Become a leader worth following. Subscribe today.
Electric Acid.